This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie was born in Nigeria and at the age of 19 moved to the Philadelphia area where she went to college and worked as a nanny. Since that time, she has gone on to write 4 books, has won numerous awards for her stories and novels that have been translated into many languages. She received a MacArthur Genius Award and now divides her time between Baltimore and Lagos. Her new novel, Americana, draws from some of her experiences in this country, and it's about immigration, it's about love, race, and hair. When the book begins, Ifemelu has been living in Princeton and has decided to go back to Nigeria. But first, she has to find a salon in Trenton to get her hair done. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie joins us once again on Radio Times. It's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Let me actually begin with the title of your book, and then I do want to have you read the very first paragraph. And it's Americana with an H on the end. And I know for Nigerians, that means something. What does it mean?
it's a playful word. So it's a word that's often used to half mockingly and playfully describe people who've been to the U.S. and who've returned to Nigeria with affectations. So who sort of come back and have very fake American accents and pretend they can no longer understand, Igbo or Yoruba or any of the Nigerian languages.
Have you ever been accused of being Americana?
Fortunately not.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very first page of your book.
Princeton in the summer smelled of nothing. And although Ifemelu liked the tranquil greenness of the many trees, the clean streets and stately homes, the delicately overpriced shops, and the quiet, abiding air of earned grace, it was this, the lack of a smell, that most appealed to her, perhaps because the other American cities she knew well had all smelled distinctly. Philadelphia had the musty scent of history. New Haven smelled of neglect. Baltimore smelled of brine, and Brooklyn of sun-warmed garbage. But Princeton had no smell. She liked taking deep breaths here. She liked watching the locals who drove with pointed courtesy and parked their latest model cars outside the organic grocery store on Nassau Street, or outside the sushi restaurants, or outside the ice cream shop that had 50 different flavors, including red pepper. Or outside the post office where effusive staff bounded out to greet them at the entrance. She liked the campus, grave with knowledge, the gothic buildings with their vine-laced walls, and the way everything transformed in the half-light of night into a ghostly scene. She liked, most of all, that in this place of affluent ease, she could pretend to be someone else, someone specially admitted into a hallowed American club, someone adorned with certainty.
I love the beginning of that book, and I would assume the first paragraph of any novel is something that a writer has to fine-tune and craft. Mm. I mean, it's the introduction to this sprawling story.
Yes, I spent a lot of time on it, needless to say. Yes.
Well, and I love the smells. I mean, I have a certain affinity for smells, but the idea that a place can have such a distinctive smell.
I remember being struck really by Princeton in the summer and thinking that it just didn't smell of anything. I notice smells, and sometimes, in a fond way or not, but I notice smells.
Tell us about Ifemelu. How would you describe her?
She is interesting. So she's
very interesting.
she's been in the U.S. for about 13 years. She came to go to university. She's sort of, it's very hard to, she's, I like to think she's a young woman who speaks her mind, who occupies her space in the world without apologizing for it. And she's spent time in the U.S. She's grown. She's sort of learned new identities. She's had relationships, and now she wants to move back to Nigeria. She doesn't. It's not so much wanting. She feels compelled to move back.
There was a quote where you said you thought of her as a quote more interesting version of you. Were you just being modest, or
no? Not at all. I was being honest. I think lots of people have said, "Oh, this is you," and I think in some ways because this is the novel that I have that it is. I suppose it's not. It's
you're going to have to do a lot of this on your book turn. Go ahead.
It's contemporary. Unlike my previous novels, it's not about people who are obviously not like me. And so because I've used some of my experiences, everyone says, oh, she's you. And she's really not. I think she's a lot more interesting than I am. My life is not that interesting. But I have used bits of me. But I think I use bits of me in all of my characters, really.
One of the things I also read was that you wanted to write a romantic story. Mm. I mean, a really romantic story, an unapologetic love story. And some of the, I'm not sure inspiration is quite the right word, but you referred to the Mills and Boone novels. And I had to go Google that because I did not know what you were talking about. Why?
It's very British.
Is it? Okay.
I actually said that tongue in cheek. I was joking about wanting to write a romantic novel in the grand tradition of the Mills and Boone romance. And of course, the Mills and Boone romance isn't a grand tradition. I read a lot of them growing up. Many of my contemporaries in Nigeria did. So Mills and Boone was sort of, I think the American equivalent would be the, is it called the Harlequin
romance? Oh, the Harlequin romance.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I went and Googled them, and some of the titles, A Throne for the King, The Sheik's Prize, Diamond in the Desert, The Final Bargain. I mean, but they're fun to read, are they not?
They were. I don't think I could read them now. I mean, when I think about it, really, there was a lot of misogyny in those novels. And when you're 13, you don't really recognize that this is just not right. But I think just the idea of romance, of a kind of just romance, was what I liked about those books and what I wanted to do with this one.
Well, Ifemelu has a number of romances. She has a childhood sweetheart, as we say, you know, who in Nigeria they grew up together, they explored each other, they loved each other.
Yes. And then they had to part.
Yes.
So it's the central love story of the book. But for me, really, it's also a novel about other kinds of love. So she has other relationships and loves the people in different ways. It's also, I think, for me, a love of reading, love of books, because this book for me is also about books. It's about just loving reading. Mm-hmm. It's about love of home, the way that one is drawn, just really drawn to home, and what does home mean, and the difference mm-hmm. of mean, yeah.
Well, especially I would think for people who are immigrants, I mean, who leave one country for another, mm-hmm. the whole idea of what is home mm-hmm. and where do I feel at mm-hmm. home? Mm-hmm.
And I think for many of those people, at some point, you're somewhere in between. You're eternally in between. I don't think I'm there yet, fortunately. Nigeria is still very much home. I like to say that I'm a Nigerian who likes America.
Well, what's interesting in this story is that Ifemelu does come to the United States, and her childhood sweetheart, Obinze, goes to England. He goes to London, but finds, you know, he can't find his place there.
He can't, and his immigration is very different from hers. But, and I think it's mostly because she's documented, he's not, and so their experiences are very different. When he's in England, he has to, you know, he's looking for a job, but he can't be legally employed, so he has to work with somebody else's identity, and you know what it does to you, that you sort of become someone else. Yeah.
One of your lines, and this goes back to smells again, the wind blowing across the British Isles was odorous with a fear of asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. And he was, I mean, in a sense, he was part of that group looking for asylum or certainly a place to live.
Yes, yes. I spent some time in England at the time when, and it did seem very much like that. It did seem that there was just a heaviness in the air, that everyone just seemed to think that all of the problems in the country were about these asylum seekers. And I wondered what it was like to be one of those people, you know, undocumented, eager and hungry for choices and for hope, and you know, what it's like to become this object of fear.
And even Obinze is sort of, one of the things you write is that people, they don't understand. He's well, he was well fed and well watered. He wasn't this, and I guess that gets to the kind of stereotype of an immigrant coming from a country like Nigeria.
Yes, because I think the story, the familiar story, and I think in general for the African continent, is that people are fleeing war and poverty, and And it's very common to hear stories of, oh, my village was burnt down, that sort of thing. But Obinze is nothing like that. So Obinze grew up on a university campus. His mother is a professor. He wasn't hungry at all. He had options in Nigeria, but he chose to leave. Just that idea of something better over there, you know, sort of real life is lived somewhere that isn't your place, so you want to go. And I think for him, what he comes to realize is that he's not easy to understand. So people look at him and they, you know, it's either they're thinking you have to be one of those people who fled extreme poverty, or they're thinking, well, if you weren't starving, why would you make this choice? Yes.
And he's also a man, a male, and she's female. I mean, I wonder whether that response is also different whether women, female immigrants are somehow viewed differently.
Mm. Hmm, that's interesting. I think so. I mean, I think gender affects everything. So I think in certain circumstances, maybe female undocumented immigrants might be viewed as somehow less dangerous, maybe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Obinze wanted to come to the U.S. and to join his love, and he couldn't. And the reason that he couldn't is he couldn't get a visa. And the reason he couldn't get a visa was that after 9/11, the U.S. embassy just would not give visas to young men. It really was just sort of a blanket thing. And if you went there to apply for a visa and you were male between the ages of 18 and, I think, 45, you had to fill extra forms. And that in itself was telling, because it meant you won't get to go.
And Ifemelu she's here, but she wants to go back. I mean, she feels that perhaps the tug of home, the tug of what's familiar, it's not as if she hasn't had struggles in the United States. Mm.
She has had. She has. And, you know, but I think also that she, I like to think that she grows and that America, in the end, was very good for her. You know, that she... Well, maybe I'm just talking about myself.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because I ran across a quote, and I can't remember if it was your character or you, which is that America's like a rich uncle who sort of doesn't really know who you are, but, you know, he's a rich uncle.
That was me. America is like it's a rich uncle who doesn't know my name but gives me pocket money.
Yes, so, exactly.
So I'm, you know, I'm sort of grateful and accepting of the limitations of the relationship.
Well, I think we're almost up at a break here, but it's so, I mean, I frankly appreciate the fact that you are confusing yourself a little bit with your main character.
No, I think I wanted to say that she grows, and I thought, wait, is that me? Because I do think that having come to the U.S., that I grew up, that if I hadn't left home, I think I wouldn't have just become the person that I am. I think I would have, you know, the sort of the relative privilege of growing up as I did. And then I left home and I grew up.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is our guest today on Radio Time. She has a new novel, Americana. Put an H on the end of that. And you can give us a call. Questions, comments, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA Continuing Education offers art classes for all ages and levels of experience this summer, including landscape, watercolor, portrait painting, and more. Featuring pre-college drawing and painting for high school students, the Summer Academy for teachers, and weekend master classes with renowned artists, including Stuart Shills and classical realist Juliet Aristides. Classes begin May 28th. Details online at pafa.edu/ce.
In Studio 360, we strive for balance.
We're trying to capture something that's real, but at the same time, we're trying to capture something that can be used to underline certain themes or ideas.
Like filmmaker Errol Morris, we can be a little opinionated. Every week, we bring you outspoken stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and big ideas. Get inside the creative mind.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
From math drills to daily piano practice, strict Asian American parents have become known as tiger moms and dads. But now some of those tiger babies are striking back.
It's actually exhausting to think that perfection is the only goal.
We have some data on how those tiger babies are actually doing, and we'll let some parents weigh in. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has written 4 books. She's won a number of literary awards. She was a MacArthur Fellow. Some of her writing has been translated into something like 30 languages. One of her novels was made into a movie. Her TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, has had millions of hits. She divides her time between the U.S. and Nigeria, where she was born, and she's got a new novel called Americana, set in Nigeria, the U.S., and London, a sprawling story of immigration, love, race, and hair. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. The book begins. She's in Princeton, and she's on her way to Trenton to have her hair done. Two extraordinarily different worlds that she goes from one to the other, probably separated by 15 miles.
Mm. Which is one of the things I found quite shocking when I first came to the U.S., how it just took a minute of walking or driving to just really enter a different world.
Hair is so much a part of the story. And I have to say to our listeners, and perhaps you could even, I mean, if you could describe your hair for us today.
My hair is in cornrows, and it's so it's all cornrows up to the top. In Nigeria, the style is called shuku, which is that the cornrows are all done to the, and then I have a bun of sorts on top. I was going to say ponytail, but that's actually not an accurate description.
No. She goes to have her hair done because she's going back to Nigeria.
Yes, and she goes to Trenton because she can't get her hair braided in Princeton. There are no African hair braiding salons in Princeton. So she goes to Trenton to braid her hair in preparation for her journey back to Nigeria.
And I have to say, she has a pretty sassy, opinionated person who's doing her hair.
Yes. her hair's being braided by a Senegalese woman who doesn't really have much time for American customer service. So she's blunt, and at some point, Ifemela starts to find her really annoying. But things change as we progress in the novel.
Indeed. And why is hair so much a part of this story? What does it mean?
It just means that I'm obsessed with hair, and so I thought I would write about what I was obsessed with, and I was hoping that everybody else would then join me in my obsession.
Oh, we're all obsessed with hair.
I'm very pleased to hear that. No, but I am interested in hair. I'm interested particularly in natural black hair, which I like to call hair that grows up, not down. But also because I think that black hair means a lot more than just hair. That we're choosing to wear your hair in a particular way often means that the world makes assumptions. So, you know, if people have dreadlocks, everyone makes assumptions. And I think particularly it's because now the norm is for black hair to be chemically relaxed. So when you choose not to do anything, you're seen as strange.
You're making a statement, right?
Yes. When actually it doesn't have to be that. It might just be that you actually just like your hair the way it grows from your head, as I do. But I realize that even though I don't necessarily want to make a political statement, I am, without meaning to, because we're living a world in which the understanding of natural black hair is something, you know, something interesting and something different. My mother doesn't like my hair.
Oh, she doesn't?
No, she doesn't. She wants me to get a chemical relax and have it straight and maybe do weaves and things of that sort. Because that's what mainstream beauty is. Right? And if you do have natural hair, you're maybe, you know, a poet or jazzy or artsy or, you know, vegetarian or a soul sister.
Perish the thought. Is there a hair you wear in Nigeria and then hair you wear in the United States? Does it come down to that?
No. My hair, I do really mostly the same things in either place. But of course in Nigeria, because I have access to many more hair braiders, I'm often more, I have more choices. Right. But, you know, hair, it's really not that different in Nigeria. In Nigeria, mainstream beauty is straight hair, which has been chemically relaxed. And even more so, it's weaves. So you add extensions to make it longer. So now, across the board in Nigeria, cutting across culture and class and region, when a woman wants to feel beautiful and she's going for a wedding, or she goes and she gets a weave, she gets extensions and they're straight. Wow. And which is why to then not have that makes you seem odd. And it's the same in the US. I mean, it's changing a bit in the US for the better, in the sense that I think natural hair and black women is slightly sort of starting to be seen as normal. In Nigeria, not so much.
Yeah. No. But certainly in the 60s, you know, when I was coming of age, it was all about that.
It was, even though I think what's in that case, I think also that it had this kind of meaning. It was sort of the, you know, black power, black is beautiful. So it wasn't just, look, I like my hair. It was, I'm taking something back, which I think for the time and place was understandable, right? But of course, what's interesting now, I think, is that sometimes people still have that understanding and they use it in the present day. So if you have a big afro and you're walking on the street, and this has happened to me a few times where, you know, people walk past and say things like black power. And I'm just thinking, oh, Lord, I just
want to wear my hair in a natural kind of way. But it takes a long time, does it not, to have the weaves and the braids and the extensions? I mean, hours and hours to have that done.
Getting braids can go 6 hours, 7, 8. If they're micro braids, you know, 9 hours.
That.
Yeah. But, you know, again, because I grew up with that, and I think for many black women, it's normal. So when I tell my friends who are not black how long it takes, they're just really shocked. And I'm thinking, well, it's not too bad.
So you get to gossip and talk and watch TV and just...
And then you get to wear it for a month or more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just sort of seems like a fair, I don't know, exchange.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book. It says about hair.
Since she came to America, she had always braided her hair with long extensions, always alarmed at how much it cost. She wore each style for 3 months, even 4 months, until her scalp itched unbearably and the braids sprouted fuzzily from a bed of new growth. And so it was a new adventure, relaxing her hair. She removed her braids, careful to leave her scalp unscratched, to leave undisturbed the dirt that would protect it. Relaxers had grown in their range, boxes and boxes in the ethnic hair section of the drugstore. Faces of smiling black women with impossibly straight and shiny hair, beside words like botanical and aloe that promised gentleness. She bought one in a green carton. In her bathroom, she carefully smeared the protective gel around her hairline before she began to slather the creamy relaxer on her hair, section by section, her fingers in plastic gloves. The smell reminded her of chemistry lab in secondary school, and so she forced open the bathroom window, which was often jammed. She timed the process carefully, washing off the relaxer in exactly 20 minutes, but her hair remained kinky, its denseness unchanged. The relaxer did not take. That was the word, take, that the hairdresser in West Philadelphia used. "Girl, you need a professional," the hairdresser said as she reapplied another relaxer. "People think they're saving money by doing it at home, but they're really not."
And that's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie reading from her new novel called Americana. And she was born in Nigeria. Actually spent some time here in the Philadelphia area where she worked as a nanny. She went to school here, spent some time at Princeton University as well. And she joins us now to talk about the writing of this novel and some of the ideas and issues in this novel as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As you were reading that, I was thinking, what if Michelle Obama, you know, just went natural? How would the world react?
Well, I think the Republicans would just go crazy, and they would, I think they would assume that Al-Qaeda had planned something with her and the hair. I mean, I really do think that it would not go well. I think people would just have all kinds of crazy reactions.
And what's been the reaction to the hair part of your story? I mean, I have to say, you know, white women think about their hair a lot as well,
so you know. Yeah, oh, absolutely, I know that.
Just maybe slightly different obsessions.
Yes, yes. I think, it's been interesting for me. I wanted to start a conversation about hair, particularly in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And I think I have. Not always a pleasant one, so I think people have sort of written angry things about, you know, why so in talking about hair, many black women will say, oh, it's just hair, right? But it really isn't, because it's also something about which people are very sensitive. Mm. So to say to a black woman, why do you have a weave? Why do you have your hair chemically straightened? The general answer is, oh, it's my choice, right? But really, people don't react very well, because I think deep down we all realize that it's really about a mainstream idea of beauty that isn't us. In other words, that mainstream beauty is about what doesn't come naturally to you. So you have to. And it's really not a question of color. It's more a question of texture, if that makes sense. Yeah. So to have kinky hair that grows up, not down, that's really dense and even woolly, is somehow to be outside of what is considered mainstream. Really, almost everywhere in the world. So not just in the West, which is what's interesting.
There's a website in the book, kinkynappysomethingorother.com, right? Where like-minded women can talk about all
this
stuff.
Yes, there is a growing...
What's the actual name?
I think it's... I made that up, actually.
Yeah,
I think it's happilykinkynappy.com. but there are many websites now. There's a growing natural hair community, and particularly in the US, among black women. And YouTube is fantastic, because lots of women on YouTube who are sharing tips about, you know, try coconut oil, it makes it soft, that sort of thing. And I spent many, many hours, instead of writing.
Oh, did you? Online?
Watching these videos on YouTube, yes. Fantastic way to waste your time.
I'm sure it is. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Zach from, looks like, City Line Avenue to join us on Radio Times. Zach, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for, thank you for picking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, Ngozi, for the book and the story. I think I don't know what to say, but I'm so excited the topic and the show.
Great.
And listening to you and your experience, and it's something that I go through every day. I love the United States. I came into the country with a high school diploma, and now I have a college degree, and I'm 36, and I'm trying to settle down and just have a family. The question is, where should I call home?
Yeah.
The United States or Ghana? I do go home every once in a while, but I just don't know where to call home. And you just said it. And that is the reason for my call.
You're very welcome, Zach. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Chimamanda, I mean, I love what he said.
Mm. Something quite moving about it.
It is.
Yes. But also, I think, for me, that maybe what I would say is that why does it have to be one place that we can, or as a friend of mine says, that home can be the airport, by which she means that home you can carry home with you. And, knowing people who've spent a lot of time in the US, but who still, because I think one is formed in one sort of the first, maybe 18 years of one's life. And I have family and friends who are very Nigerian, but who also have really taken to America. And sometimes I watch them and I think they would just never survive moving back to Nigeria. But at the same time, they're not Americans in the way that American-born Americans are. And so they've become something else, something in the middle, which I also think is fine. I mean, I think we can have a middle ground.
Zach, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I know one of the things, and you lived and worked in Philadelphia when you were starting at the age of 19. One of the things that you said that you didn't think about the color of your skin or your blackness until you came to America.
Yes. I think for being Nigerian, I think this is true for most of West Africa, where just race isn't. And I say West Africa in particular because it's obviously different in South Africa and in East Africa as well. We just don't think of ourselves. We don't think about skin color. And I find it interesting now when I go back to Nigeria, my friends who've never left Nigeria really don't get race. They really don't. And I realize that this is one of the ways in which I've become Americanized, that I notice race now in a way that I wouldn't have if I hadn't come. In Nigeria, I was Igbo, which is my ethnic group. And then in the US, suddenly I was sort of this thing called black. And I really resisted it for a long time. And I think it's because having not even been in the U.S. for very long, I knew already that black was not a good thing to be in the U.S.
You got that message?
Very, very early. And I was in Brooklyn, and an African American man called me sister, and my reaction was almost visceral. I thought, no, I'm not your sister, because it means I'm going to be in this group that, you know, because I'd been watching TV, and it seemed to me that that all those cop shows where everybody who's arrested, where they just cherry pick all the black people and show them, and I thought, no, I'm not in this group. This is not me. But really, and I think this is, you know, it's something I laugh about now, but I think it also says something larger about how many immigrants leave Africa, come to the US, discover race, and then in some ways, in their bid to succeed, because I think to be an immigrant is really just to try to do better, that sometimes they think that the way to succeed is to try and distance themselves as much as possible from African Americans and the African American experience. And what's sad about it is they don't realize that they actually are able to prosper because of so many sacrifices made by African Americans. And it took me a lot of reading and learning to understand that. And now, if that man called me sister, I would be happy.
Well, it's interesting because in the novel, Femalu, at one point she says, you know, I'm going to stop trying to Americanize my accent. I'm going to sound like who I am. And I wonder whether, as a young woman coming to America, whether you did the same kind of thing.
I did a really good American accent.
Oh, there you go.
I used to do a very good one. I actually don't even know how to do it anymore. But I did because, you know, you're an immigrant. You come to the U.S. I didn't want to stand out. I realized that in class I would open my mouth and everybody would turn to me, you know, where are you from? And so I started to do a very good American, and then one day I just thought, this is nonsense. It's false. It wasn't me. It took a lot of effort to do, and I thought, you know, I've been speaking English my entire life. English is my first language, and I don't know why I then have to become this other version of myself that isn't the true me. And so I thought, you know what, if there's an earthquake today and I'm woken from sleep, in what accent will I speak? And I thought, that's the accent I'm going to speak with from now on. And so I stopped the fake American. But you know, I say that, but I also recognize how for many people it's a way of succeeding.
Sure, you know, fitting in.
Yeah. You want to get a job and you don't want Americans to constantly ask you, where are you from? Or to make you feel that you don't belong. So then you do the accent because you want to fit in. So I completely understand that. Mm-hmm. It was just a choice that I made for myself. I thought, no, I'm not going to.
And did you, we're almost about to break here, did you get close to the Philadelphia accent?
I don't think so,
no. Beautiful.
No, I think I sort of had the more generic educated American accent, which I don't think I had the Philly.
The Philly accent. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also get back to our callers as well. And Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is our guest today on Radio Times. She's written a number of books, four books, her new novel called Americana. And it has an H on the end of it for a very important reason. It's set in Nigeria, where our guest was born, in the United States, where she lives part-time as well, also set in London. A sprawling story of immigration, love, race, and hair. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at drinkinginphilly.com.
Tell me the story of us.
Again?
All right, Francis.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the new film Frances Ha with director Noah Baumbach and actress Greta Gerwig. It's about a young woman in the transition from college student to adult, dealing with relationships with both men and women that are often ambiguous and open-ended. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now.
We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Abu from Roxborough to join us. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, how you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Fine, I'm just letting you know that I'm enjoying the show.
Good.
For your guest, Ngozi, I'm also from Nigeria.
Hello.
Yeah. I'm also from Nigeria and reside in Philadelphia for the past 30 years.
Wow.
I find it very interesting about what you're saying about your hair, about hair. You know, people in Nigeria, I'm surprised that they don't like to wear their hair naturally. They want to be, they want to look like the American, and whereas the American want to look like Africa. You know, so I don't know if you get what I'm talking about. So you have to look Western to be accepted, whereas the American here want to look like Africa. So I mean, what do you have to say about that?
Well, that's an interesting point, Abu. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mamanda, go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know about Americans wanting to look African. I don't know about that. I mean, but I think just in a larger sense that it's really about how the world is becoming this homogenous place. And I think the massive cultural power that the West has is partly the reason. So in Nigeria, for example, young people are watching a lot more American media content. So I go back and people, you know, the young people know much more about Beyonce than I think young Americans know about Beyonce. And there's a kind of, I think there's a kind of aspiring to things of that sort that, you know, people watch Kim Kardashian seriously in Nigeria, which I have to say just really, it horrifies me.
I mean, with bemusement?
No.
Are they laughing at her?
No. They're watching it seriously. They're admiring the, which, you know, and I say to my friends in Nigeria, you know, in the US, yes, they watch it. Most people do, but it's ironic. They watch it and they're sort of bemused, but not in Nigeria. And I think that's one of the things about exporting cultural content, because often the layers don't go with that. So you export the content, but then the nuances of it don't actually travel across either. So that doesn't translate, and so people don't quite get that this is not supposed to be taken seriously. But yes, so
well, based on what you just said there, it'd be interesting once people start to read your book how different the reaction would be in the United States compared to Nigeria.
Yes, I think people are going to read it very differently. And also in the
UK.
Are
you worried about that? Or are you willing to sort of let it go?
I think there's a level. No, I do feel a level of anxiety. I think particularly in the US, for the US. I've only just started. It's only just come out today. And I've already toured the UK and Nigeria. And even those two have, the UK and Nigeria, the readings were quite different. The reactions were quite different. And I think the reason I have a bit of anxiety about the US is obviously because this book is Nigerian, but really it's also American. It's about America. And so, yes, I do have a bit of anxiety.
See what your rich uncle will say, yes. You have speaking of that, you have a character in here, a woman named Kimberly.
Yes.
And she thinks Ifemelu is a beautiful name. She thinks black is beautiful, and she, you know, she's effusive in her I guess love of black people. But Ifemelu has a response to her.
Kimberly is this really lovely woman who employs her and helps her. But Kimberly would say to her, "I have this beautiful friend." And at some point, Ifemelu realized that every time Kimberly said that about people, she just meant black, because most of these people were quite ordinary looking, but they were always black. And so she said to Kimberly, "You know, you can just say black, and not every black person is beautiful."
Yeah.
And for me, that really was about, I think, this incredible discomfort in the US about race, about talking about race. And so people just will not say black or say race. They'll say culture when they really mean race. So Kimberly really meant black, but And in some ways, again, because of America's history, I understand that discomfort, but it's something I think really gets in the way of just real connection between people. Because now people, often people can't really say what they're thinking. So I think Kimberly, for example, would not say if she thought a black person was ugly.
She would not say that.
She would not say that. But, you know, there are black people who are ugly, and one should be able to say so.
But do you think she sort of represents the sort of well-intentioned, liberally white person who,
yes,
you know, doesn't want to be seen as a racist?
Yes. But I think, yes, I think Kimberly is very much that. She's so full of good intentions. She really means well. Right. And so it would be so much easier if she was, you know, sort of nasty and horrible, because then you could dismiss it. Right. But she's well meaning. And I think maybe that's part of the problem, that one of the things about race in the US is there's so much discomfort. People have moved from insensitivity to a kind of massive sensitivity that in itself isn't sensitive, because, you know, it's just the idea of beautiful being black. I think for some people, for Ifemelu, for example, she finds it irritating, because she's thinking, well, there's something dishonest about it as well, right? And but again, it's complex and complicated, but yeah, Kimberly, I think for Ifemelu as well, I think Kimberly starts to, when a friendship develops, and actually the minute that Ifemelu says to her, you know, you can say black, not every black person is beautiful. For Ifemelu, that's when the friendship begins.
Yeah.
That's when a real connection happens.
An honest moment,
yes,
I guess.
Yes,
yes. Just to add to the complexity of the story, Ifemelu also starts a blog. The blog is titled Race Teenth, or Various Observations About American Blacks, and then in quotations, or in parentheses rather, those formerly known as Negroes by a non-American black. You had a lot of fun with these blogs.
Yes? I did very much. I actually laughed writing them. And I'm kind of, you know, I really do hope that people see the humor in it, because it's part of starting conversations, but it's also things that are really absurd about race that I think one should laugh about. And for me, being an outsider, so being the non-American black, just watching, sometimes it's just really funny.
Well, on that note, I'm passing the book to you. I'd love to have you read one of Ifemelu's blog posts.
So this blog post is titled, To My Fellow Non-American Blacks. In America, you're black, baby. Dear non-American black, when you make the choice to come to America, you become black. Stop arguing. Stop saying, I'm Jamaican or I'm Ghanaian. America doesn't care. So what if you weren't black in your country? You're in America now. We all have our moments of initiation into the society of former Negroes. Mine was in a class in undergrad when I was asked to give the black perspective, only I had no idea what that was, so I just made something up. And admit it, you say, I'm not black, only because you know black is at the bottom of America's race ladder, and you want none of that. Don't deny now. What if being black had all the privileges of being white? Would you still say, don't call me black, I'm from Trinidad? I didn't think so. So you're black, baby.
And again, that's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie reading from her new novel called Americana. And those blogs, they are fun. I mean, you're having fun, she's having fun, and she's tweaking, but also raising, I think, important issues about race.
Yes. Yes, I think so. I think in this case, it's, again, that the immigrant or the non-American black, so people who've come from the Caribbean, from Africa, from Europe, and who in many ways come to the US and decide that they're not black. I mean, I have heard immigrants, African immigrants, say, I'm not black. And I know how loaded that is and what that means. This is Ifemelu's way of saying, no, you don't get to choose. But also really, in the larger sense, saying America forces identity on you, that you don't really have much of a choice. I mean, in the ways that, in the areas where race matters, America doesn't give you a choice. So if it's a question of, I'll use one of the stereotypical examples. You go into a store and somebody thinks that because you look a certain way, you might steal something in the store. If you're in the US, you know, the store, that person in the store is not going to stop and ask you, are you from Jamaica or are you, you know, it's I think one of the absurdities of race, how immediate it is, how it's about how you look.
Well, it wasn't so long ago in this country, if you had, you know, 1/16th black blood, you were considered black.
Yes.
I mean, it came, got down to the sort of DNA blood level.
Mm. And God save you if you actually looked like you might have some black in you. I mean, I was just reading these accounts of the American South, and it was just incredible how sometimes they would just look and they would sort of see a slight kink of hair and say, oh, yes, this person has some black in them. And
Do you have a blog? I mean, like your character?
I don't, but I actually...
Are you thinking of starting one?
I think Ifemelu is thinking about continuing her blog.
as the book lives on, so might the blog.
Yes. Yes.
I was looking at your TED Talk, which I think got, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 million hits. This was a talk about Africa, really. And the talk was titled The Danger of a Single Story. The idea that when people say, well, I'm from Nigeria, I'm from Africa, then there is this sort of knee-jerk response about a continent versus the diversity of people.
Mm. But also in a larger sense about, so in that talk I gave an example of how I'm guilty of that, how I think really all of us are, and that for me it's about constantly sort of reminding myself that there's more about a person or a place than the single thing, and how I was in the U.S., I'd been watching TV quite a bit, and there was a lot of talk about immigration, and Mexicans sort of made the made responsible for everything that was wrong with the system, and really the demonization of Mexicans. And then I went to Mexico, and I remember that my first impression was surprise, and I was so ashamed of myself because I thought, wait, why am I surprised? I'm surprised because somehow I've come here and it doesn't fit that single thing of Mexicans that's kind of, you know, the people crossing the border and, you know, I don't know, defrauding the health system, that kind of nonsense. And I got to Mexico and I just thought, oh my Lord, it's a complex place of many stories and many, you know. And I was so ashamed myself, but for me it was very striking because I'm sort of used to slightly self-righteously lecturing people about how this is really bad. And so then I got to Mexico, I thought, okay, I think I need to lecture myself now. But
a little talk in the mirror, right?
Yes.
Was this a hard book to write? And I have to say, it's almost 500 pages. That's a big novel, a big hefty novel.
It was. There are moments when I... But in some ways, I'm happy that it was difficult to write. I think if it had been easy, I don't know if I would have all the feelings I have about it. There were moments when I loved writing it and had a lot of fun, and just other times when I just thought, how did I ever write a novel before? Because it's so hard. And there were parts of it also that just I struggled to get right. I struggled to like. But in the end, I was very pleased. I'm very pleased with it, if I...
Well, no, yes. I think you're... I mean, I would hope that once a novelist writes a book or a painter paints a painting, that they like what they have done.
Not always, but in this case,
understand.
I do. Yeah, I do like it very much, yes. I read bits of it and I find myself laughing, and then I start to worry because I think, is it a bad thing to be so amused by your own humor? I mean, is it a good sign? I don't know.
Do you have a certain method of writing? I mean, sometimes writers are very ritualistic about what they do, and they make sure they have a kind of almost like a 9-to-5 job.
No, I don't know how to do that. I have friends who do that, and I both admire that and also find it vaguely annoying because I just think, well, how could I write when it's going well? And I can write really. I prefer to write at night, but if it's going well in the morning, I write in the morning. But what I think, if there is a process to my walk, it's that I'm almost obsessively focused. Mm. So if I'm walking and it's going well, I just don't do anything else. I don't want to do anything else. I'm just really deeply focused and also deeply happy.
And deeply happy. And when it's going well, just means that it feels fluid. It feels part of you.
Yes.
Are the words tumbling out? Or
sometimes they tumble out. Other times I have to sort of pry them out. But what it means is that I feel that I'm... And it's so strange to talk about it without sort of sounding silly. But it's kind of like being in the zone. I feel as though I'm... It's almost like being high. It is. And I feel the characters come alive. And I'm just really... And again, the only way I can say it is that I'm just deeply happy. It's when I'm happiest. I'm happiest when I'm writing and I feel that I'm communing with the spirits. But then on the other hand, when it's not going well, it's really bad.
It's hard. Mm. It's hard. One of your books has been made, I guess, into a movie. It's going to open, I'm not sure exactly when, but I guess sometime this year.
Yes. Yes.
And it stars Tawny Newton, who, as I had told you, she's just an actress that I have followed.
I think she's lovely. And so Half of a Yellow Sun, the movie, right, which I saw a few months ago, finally, the director showed it to me.
Wow.
And I think it's a very beautiful film. But I wasn't involved at all because I just didn't want to be involved in cutting up my baby, Half of a Yellow Sun, the novel being my baby. But it's, you know, I think, I suppose it's a nice thing that one's book is being made into a film. But I do have to say that I much prefer books to films. Mm-hmm. I think books are just...
Well, I would think as the writer, you've sort of made the movie, right? In your head?
It's very, and then when I was watching it, it felt very strange because, and then at some point I forgot that I had written the book, and then I was just really engrossed and wondering what was going to happen next. And then I thought, oh, right, I did write the book, didn't I? Although the film isn't quite, I mean, there are a few things that are different. But it's a very strange thing because these characters, and particularly for that novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, that had such, meant so much to me emotionally. And so then to watch this thing on the screen, and I'm thinking, sometimes the characters are not quite what I imagine them to be. So it was a very strange thing.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us today at Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, our guest. And her new novel is called Americana, again with an H on the end, set in Nigeria, the U.S., and London. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including a Facebook and Twitter, email archives, podcast, Sirius Satellite Radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Artie Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.